Okay, then I guess we'll start with the presentation. So I'm Thomas Kinnan, and I'll be talking about data-driven and component-based game entities, which sounds really fancy, but is maybe not even so fancy. So let me give you a short overview of what I'm going to talk about today. So first I'm going to introduce myself and why we actually want to talk about such complicated topic. And then I'm going to explain the small parts about it so that you actually understand what it's about and give you some real examples of how this is used in games and how we at Unknown Horizons tried to use this great thing for our architecture. So, as I said, I'm Thomas Kinn. I study computer science, nothing great, and I work at Unknown Horizons, which is a great game. It's a real-time strategy game. Some of you may know Anno 1603 or 1503 AD. It's pretty similar. It's our main influence source. We love those games. So we decided to step up and build an open source kind of influence version of this. And we started with this about 3 years ago. But this talk is not about Unknown Horizons. This talk is about game entities and especially game architecture. So why do we need game architecture? I mean, architecture is like, you do that at university or at work, it's software engineering, it's not fun, right? I want to build games, that's supposed to be fun, I want to do that in my free time. But, as we've heard before, games are not easy to build. And really big games, like Westnoth or Unknown Horizons or any major game that is sold today, is so insanely huge that you will never be able to build it without using a correct architecture, without plugging your components together in the correct way. Because if you don't, you will end up with a big pile of shit. So let me give you a good motivation. First of all, a nice architecture is easy to extend, and it's easy to maintain. Because if you have good parts that are separate from each other, you can build on them with many people without them interfering with each other. As I said, separation of labor. You want to have many people build on the same thing, but on separate parts. For example, in the Linux kernel, you don't want everybody to have to know the entire architecture of the kernel. You will never, ever get a line of code written. And for games, what's most important is that it's easy to add content. If you have a nice architecture that makes it easy to add content for your game designers and content contributors, they can do that in a nice fashion. Because if you have a bad architecture, you will need your programmers to help your game designers implement stuff. And if that's the case, you will be stealing a lot of time from your programmers that they need to make the game nicer instead of helping your game designers implement new objects. So I'm going to first start with what component-based is actually about and why we need that. So I'm going to first start off with an example of how architecture can look in Unknown Horizons. You're not supposed to read anything. It's just a big class hierarchy. This used to be our main class hierarchy for our settler building. This is like our main pioneer building. So that's 18 classes in that hierarchy. You can see all these nice things. You have these crossovers here. And trust me if I say, it's a lot of fun if you want to change something in that. Because everything conflicts with everything else. And then we have this nice situation that our game is written in Python. So we can actually have things named in the same way, and they can have a different type, and nobody will tell me until the game crashes. So that's a really big problem. But this is what happens if you don't have a game architecture when you start with your project. When we started, basically none of us knew what they were doing. So the game just kind of grew, and we added classes here and there. Hey, we need something to move, so we're going to put a movable class. And somehow this big thing came out. Now today, if you want to change something, you're probably going to break something. And that's a really big problem. Which is why I read up on component-based architectures and tried to implement that. So let me explain what that is. Let me first tell you why it's bad. So this is bad because it's difficult to test. Because if you look at this, then if you want to test some functionality that's in here, you need to be able to instantiate all the classes in the hierarchy. And they will probably touch every single part of your code of the entirety of the game at some point. So to make a simple unit test for the class down below, you basically need to build up the entire game just to run a test. So that's almost impossible to do without like running the entire game. So that's really bad. And because it's difficult to test, as I said, it's difficult to maintain. Because you always introduce bugs, regression bugs, that you just find weeks later, and nobody knows how to fix them. Now, this comes especially from the fact that we use Python, because we have problems with member variable naming and method naming. Because if we have this big hierarchy, if we have a variable name ID or name, which is pretty common to use in a class for whatever thing, it will just override it. And it can have an integer in one class and a string in another class, and the Python compiler won't even care. It will just work until the game crashes at some point where it expects an int where it's a string. So this is really a big problem. And something else that comes from this is a very high complexity of your tracebacks when you get crashes. Because by changing, if we subclass a lot, we usually overwrite methods maybe like 2 times or maybe even 3 times. So if you get a crash in there somewhere, it will go up the hierarchy somewhere and it will go down and it will go up and it will go down. So our longest traceback was 68 calls just for one single crash. That's like 3 times scrolling your console. That's really, really, really bad. And if you want to debug it, then you have all your game classes open. You really don't understand what's happening. So you want to put that together. Now, we can do that by introducing components. Now, a basic component is like a class of functionality that you put in one place. And it's supposed to depend on as few things as possible. So for example, if you want to render something, you make a render component, like an animation component, which handles only the animation of the object and nothing else. So that will probably be the part where all of your rendering code is and all of the OpenGL code maybe. So that is separate from the rest. Then, for example, in a real-time strategy game, you often have buildings that produce stuff. So you could have a producing component that has all the stuff that manages how production is done, that manages resources coming in and out. And you'll have an inventory component, for example, and try to keep these as dependency-free as possible. It's all obviously not possible all the time. For example, a producer will probably need an inventory, so he has something to work with. But the general idea is clear, I think. You want to keep those separate so that you can work on single units without interfering with other stuff. Now, if you've gone to university and studied some computer science, you've probably heard this a lot. You want to favor composition over inheritance. Now, while this is not always true, we kind of want to do that here. Because we can't really get to separate all this stuff, and we lose all the problems that we have with inheritance. And we also want to use composition because we can plug together the parts in a much more flexible way than we can do with inheritance. Now, let's look at an example from 0ID. In 0ID, an object is basically just a number. So you have some unique ID that represents your number, and then you have a list of components connect to that, like an attack component, or a visual actor, cost, a position. Now you can see how fine-grained this actually is, because the visual actor can never kind of function without the position, because it will always have to know where it wants to render something on the screen. And you can easily see how powerful this actually is, because imagine you have a tree on your map that just stands around and doesn't do anything, and now you want to have a tree that can attack something. Now you just add the attack component, and voila, your tree can attack. So you have this Lord of the Rings style tree that walks around and attacks everything, which is really great, because it's very easy to implement. Now, this is also very easy to test, because now you have things that are very small, and they're decoupled from the rest of the code. So it's much easier to write unit tests for this, which is great, because then you can have continuous integration, run your tests every commit, and hopefully, if you have enough tests, you won't introduce so many regression bugs. Now, at Unknown Horizons, we moved a little bit to this approach. Not yet completely there, but like halfway maybe. And we can now run a lot of tests, and we kind of tripled our test base, I think. And it helps a lot, trust me, it's great. It's also very flexible, because you can connect these things in a lot of different ways. As I said before with the tree, you can combine these in very in very different fashions to create new objects without actually writing new code. So you can kind of create new behaviors just by combining new components. With these small blocks, you can have people working on every block. You can have somebody working on one block and somebody on the other block without them actually having to know each other, which if the project grows bigger is pretty important, because if you have 50 people talking with 50 other people, you get a lot of communication overhead. And what's best about the component-based approach is that it works perfectly together with data-driven stuff. And I will explain why now. Not now. Soon. We have to first understand one other thing. Obviously, if we separate everything, it can't communicate. So that's a big problem. Obviously, stuff has to communicate somehow. For example, if I have a building that has a storage, like, let's say, a lumberjack, he gets some trees, and now he's supposed to produce some boards from it. Now, somehow, the storage component has to tell the producer component, look, I got something. Now, in our old approach, that was really not a problem. We could just call some function on the hierarchy. That's awesome, right? Well, it's not. What's much better is you use some sort of message bus. Now, the message bus is something like, you could consider it maybe like a post office. A component can send a message to the message bus, and then other components, or even other parts of your game, can register at the message bus to receive certain types of messages. So, for example, in our example before, the storage component would send like an inventory updated message to the message bus. Now, the producer component would listen for these kind of messages, and then he would know what to do. Now, what's great about this is that I can not only do one-to-one communication, but one-to-many. So, for example, if I have clicked on the lumberjack, I'm probably displaying its inventory. So now the GUI also wants to be updated. Now it can also just register to the message bus and get these messages and be updated that way. And the best thing about that is that the storage component doesn't know anything about that. So it just has to send the message and it's done. So it doesn't need to know the GUI, doesn't need to know the storage component, and by doing that you kind of decouple everything very nicely. So if you want to add another one, like the statistics module, for example, so you want to collect how many things your producer produced during the entire game, which is always great for these big statistics screens that you have at the end of your game, like in Age of Empires, where you can see 10,000 different numbers, like, yeah, I produced 500 wood more than you did, so I'm better, kind of things. It's great for these things. Now, how you implement that is kind of up to you. You can, like, have a message class that does all the registering and sending by itself, or you could have a separate message class where the messages like kind of get routed through. But what you have to consider is performance. Now, in the basic approach, if you have one big message bus and everything registers there and every message goes through there, then everybody who registers kind of has to decide if he wants to use a message. So, for example, our GUI registers for the inventory updated message. Now, let's say I have 10,000 trees on my map. They kind of grow and they produce a wood inside. Now I get inventory updated message 10,000 times. So I maybe get 500 a second or something. And all these 500 messages have to go to all the people who listen for these inventory updated messages, which is like every building, because almost every building produces something. So you can clearly see how that is a problem. So you have to kind of implement some performance boost there so that you can only register for messages from a certain type of building, or in some extreme cases you might even have to register for a certain instance only. Now then you get quite tight coupling again, but you can only do that for very extreme cases where that's really necessary. For the GUI, for example, that might be necessary to keep it responsive. Good. Now let's talk about data-driven. Data-driven is something that pretty much every project has if it gets to a certain size, because otherwise it's not usable. So I'm going to define that in like three small steps. First of all is data affects code's behavior. That's like the simplest thing that you learn first when you start programming, that you don't want to hard code your numbers right into the algorithm, because that's kind of bad. You want to be able to put different inputs in there. Now the second part is that you want to separate that data from the code, so you want to save it somewhere else. You can save it in a database or a file. that's kind of where you save it doesn't really matter. It just has to be somewhere else. Now, in games, it might matter a little bit because that data is supposed to be touched by somebody who doesn't know how to code. So for a bad example, take us. We stored our data in SQLite to begin with. Now, that's pretty cool because it's awesomely fast and you can do relational queries on it. That's pretty cool for coding. But now, if you get to this great point where somebody joins your IRC channel and is like, well, the Lumberjack kind of produces too slow. I want to kind of figure out what happens if it produces twice as much in the same time. Then we sit there and it's like, yeah, that's really easy. You just download your SQLite manager, open up the database, check out the resource ID, check out the billing ID, go to the production line table, check out which production line you use, and you check out which production lines it has, and then you can find the time somewhere, and you adjust it, and you're done. It's that simple. And the people are like, okay, that's great, I'm going to leave. So they go. And you successfully scared them away. And this just didn't happen one time, it happened a lot of times. So you can see how this is bad. So you really want to have something that is kind of accessible. Like whatever, XML, YAML, or flat-based file, just anything that people can open up with their editor and kind of understand. Now, the third part is kind of the most important part. You want to have your game entities defined by data, not code. So in a real extreme scenario, you don't have any class for a specific building. Now, we had the settler class, or we would have a lumberjack class to combine like the functionality. But in a really cool architecture that's purely data-driven and component-based, you could just have a file that lists the number of components and thereby defines how the building works. So you don't really have special classes. But the data really defines how the code works and how the game works. Now that's really, really important because that allows your game designers to change how your game works without touching code. So like in the example with a tree that's supposed to attack, you could also make it movable by adding a movable component. So you can see how that really adds a lot of power to your game designers because they can try out new concepts very easily and don't have to bug your programmers to do something about that. So let's look at how that works in some real scenarios. Probably the nicest example in open source I found for that is ZeroAD. They have a really, really, really clear architecture, and it's very powerful. So let's look at how it works. First of all, it's kind of split up into two parts if you have the ZeroAD game. First of all, you have the mod, which is kind of where all the content from the game lives, and you have the engine. The engine is where all the rendering is done and how sounds are handled and fonts are handled. And these are pretty separate from each other. Now you can see they have C++ components. And why I wrote that they have C++ components is because they can have JavaScript components on the mod side. Now this is really, really cool because you can implement a component in C++ if it needs a lot of performance. Say for example for rendering, but you can also implement it in JavaScript if it does something simple. But these components are on the same level. They can do the same things through the JavaScript interface. Now, why is this really cool? Because if you have, for example, the attack code in your JavaScript, then you can run the game and you can change the JavaScript component while the game is running. And the game will hot load the JavaScript component and you can see the changes in the game directly. So that's pretty cool for the programmer to try out new code. And also for debugging, because if there's an error in the JavaScript component, it doesn't crash the entire game. Then the component is just restarted. So if there's a really big error, you can open the game, run it, work with the component, it crashes, you fix something in the JavaScript file, and you can test it right again without restarting the game. Now in a big game like ZeroAD, which is it's a pretty nice 3D graphics game, it takes quite a while to load. So you can see how that saves you a lot of time. Now, in ZeroAD, all the communication goes through the message bus or through direct calling of methods. So there's this thing called the component handler, which I marked as message bus here, so that you can easily see where it is. And you can also get a component for a certain entity, because we saw that the list of components is just mapped to an ID. So you can say, I want to have the producing component for the ID 500, let's say, and then you can call a message directly. Sometimes you have to do that because it's important for performance reasons, because the overhead of sending a message might just be too big. But in general, you try to send the messages, because that really decouples your code. Now, the second thing that you have in the game mod are the XML entity definitions. That's basically where 0ID stores what the game is like, because there all the buildings and units are stored. And it's just a basic XML file, like we can see here, which is basically a list of components. So you can see the attack component, the health component, the unit motion component, and the visual actor, together with all the important data that makes out this component. So now, let's say I get somebody coming to IRC, and he says, hey, I want to make my unit move twice as fast. And you say, well, open up the file and put up the max speed, and you double that number, and you're done. And he's like, wow, that's awesome. He opens the file, and he's like, oh, cool, I can also change the health. And he starts playing around, and he probably sticks with you because it's really easy to do, and it's a lot of fun. And also, he now has the power to add functionality to that class, right? So he can really work with the game without talking to anybody who really knows the engine. So now let's talk about Unknown Horizons again. We had this really ugly thing that I showed you in the beginning. So our idea was, well, this is bad. We have to change this. We want to have this component-based thing so that people can come and work on our game design without always having to talk to a programmer. Now, that's really a problem. Because if you have a really big existing architecture and it works, and moving it to something completely different, that's kind of an insane idea. If you've ever tried that, you know that it's crazy. Well, I still tried. And there's basically two things you need. You need time and you need more time. So a good place to do that is if you have a university project where you have to write a report and you get to implement it for 10 credits a semester, where you can work on it 30 hours a week and you actually get something for doing it. So that's what I did, and I spent 3 months building our entire architecture to something completely different. Now, because you can't do that in one step, I had to kind of build something that is some intermediate thing, which is really kind of undefined, but it works. I'm going to show you how it works. So our idea was that we can't like move the entire code to a component-based approach in one step, because that's just crazy. So we wanted to move small parts first. So the idea was that we have our old inheritance tree here, where all the things are that we don't want to touch yet. And then we have this thing that we call a component holder, which manages the new components. Now then we create all these new components, like the storage component I talked about earlier, or health component, or producing component. And we collect those to work with the old inheritance tree. Now, I cannot stress enough how crazy an idea it is to pull something out of a big inheritance tree like that. You go to the middle and you're like, I want the producing code, and you take it out. And it took me 5 days, 5 days of every day working to get the game to start again before it actually, so I could load it again.
Having tests helps.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the problem, because we couldn't have tests before. So we didn't have a lot of tests. So my way of testing was running the game, putting the AI on highest speed, and waiting until the game crashes. Now that works pretty well, but it's a pretty slow kind of process. So yeah, you should really, if you want to do something like that, have a lot of time. And fixing all the bugs that were introduced with this thing, that kind of lasts till today. So it took another 2 or 3 months after we merged my changes back to kind of fix all the bugs that we introduced. So now the code is starting to get stable again. You can actually play the game without having to fear that it crashes when you save or load. And this, of course, also breaks how save games work, because you have to do so many changes, it's almost impossible to port an old save game. So yeah, there are, as the talker who was before me said, there are some places where you just can't have safe game compatibility. So you just have to break it. We do it all the time anyway, so it doesn't matter. But yeah. Okay, so in our case, we don't like XML, or I don't like XML. It's just my personal unpleasure with working with AND when working with Java. So we decided to use YAML because we think it's a lot easier to read. Now, you can look at it, and it's your choice if it's easier or not, but you can see how it works. At the top, we have the base class, which is kind of our old part of the inheritance tree, because we still need those base classes to add the functionality that is not yet in the producer code, right? So we have to have the attributes for those things kind of on the first level. But then we also have a list of components, where here you can already see, for example, the health component, where it's very easy to change the health or to change how much we can put into a storage. So it's gotten a lot easier to change things. Also, down here, you can add new, what we call an action set is like an animation, a set of animations that the unit works with. So for example, if you have trees, you don't just want to have one single tree for the game, because that looks really boring, so you want to have like 20 of those. And it used to be very difficult to add those because you had to work with the SQLite database again. So for somebody who does graphics, opening an SQLite thing is usually something where they go, help, I don't want to do that. So now it's very easy. Great, so let's give a short summary. Data-driven architectures ease content creation. Now, as we've seen, your game designers can now work without talking to the people who program on the engine. So that's great, and it allows them to work much faster. This is really a problem, because we've had this quite a lot of times, that people come, hey, look, I made these nice graphics for this fire station. And you're like, okay, we'll implement it sometime. And then maybe 6 weeks later, somebody finally finds the time to put it into the game. Now, by that time, the guy who contributed the fire station, he's gone. Because he hates you, because he spent an entire weekend making this fire station, and you just put it somewhere and didn't use it. So he's gone, and he will never come back. So this is something you really want to avoid. Now, as I've said, it's really easy to test. We have a continuous integration running Jenkins, and it's awesome. It spams our IRC channel with every test that fails, and it does so after every commit, and I cannot stress how annoying it is.
That's lovely.
And that is exactly the point, because it will make people fix stuff. Because after the 10th time when they see this test is still broken, they're like, oh God, this cannot possibly be here again, because it's like the 20th time of the day. And then somebody goes and fixes it, which is a really nice way to get people to work. And the combination separates game design from code as much as possible. Of course, this is not entirely possible, but it's pretty possible. So if you start a new project, you should do something like this. And if you already have a project, you can think about it. But if you want to really do it, you need a lot of time, like weeks of time. And you have to accept that it will probably introduce so many bugs that you will not be able to make a release for half a year. Now, if that is what you do anyway, that's no problem. But if you have continuous releases every week, then that is probably something you do not want. All right, questions and feedback.
Then you have inter-component dependencies, like you have a graphics component that needs a position from the position component.
Yes.
How do you make sure that everything is initialized in the right order?
In our case, in the component class, you can specify dependencies on other classes, which we implemented pretty simply by overriding the less than operator. So we can just throw it in a list and have it sorted by the Python sorter mechanism. And then we get the correct order out of it. And then you're done.
It sounds like we're still in the honeymoon period with this new component-based architecture.
Yes.
What are the problems that you've had with it, or what are the problems that you foresee having? Because it's not all puppies and kittens forever.
Yeah, well, it's of course a little more difficult to implement, because you really have to separate everything. So It takes a little bit more thought to implement it, and it takes a little more imagination to build together the object than in the typical inheritance-based approach. And another thing which is not that easy is the point with the message bus. Because, as I said, performance really matters in games, and you kind of have to find a way to make it so that the components are not tightly coupled, but it still has to be fast enough. So you might end up with multiple message buses on multiple levels. So you might have one top level for the statistics collection, but you might also have one for every unit in the game that kind of just handles the stuff that goes on inside of the unit. So that is something that we're still trying to figure out a little bit, and I think that we'll need kind of some trial and error to get kind of right. But you can always start pretty top level and then just go down and make it more special in case you need it. So I think that'll be pretty good to figure out.
I have some experiences with the message, with system that have message bus, and
yep.
I just wanted to ask you, how do you debug the message passing, and how do you actually find which of the components that are supposed to pass all the messages have the bug that you are trying to find?
That is a very good question, because we do not have the message bus yet. So we have not had that problem yet. But I see that is probably going to happen if you have a very general message bus.
Would you say that component-based architecture contradicts the object-oriented approach in general? Because you say you try to avoid inheritance.
Well, I try to avoid inheritance for building together my objects. There's nothing wrong with using inheritance. For example, for our storage component, we have different inventory classes, like where you can put in a total amount or some that have special slots, and we do that all by subclassing. There's nothing wrong with doing that. It's just for this special approach, together with the data-driven part, that you kind of need to separate these things into components so that you can plug them together very easily.
Common problem in component-based architectures is performance.
Yes.
You tend to separate and more and more and more, and then you go and load stuff, and things start getting slow. Are you noticing this? And
yes, we are. We've had a lot of improvements for map loading stuff on the old way it was implemented, and after we had the component thing, it almost tripled in loading time, but we've improved it again, and it's pretty much back to where we were. So we could pretty much fix it to be as fast as before. Obviously, you need a lot more classes now. You need to instantiate a lot more objects. So this could be a problem. But for us, usually somewhere in the rendering pipeline, the problem is with the performance and not with the game code, because the game logic just makes up maybe 5 or 10% of the entire time spent calculating stuff for the game. So we don't usually care too much about how the performance of our game code is. Of course, there are places, if you select an object, for example, which has to be really, really fast, and you have to look at it, but in general, I think it's not a big problem, especially because computers are very fast today. Yes?
What do you pass along the data bus? For the message bus, is it purely the notification, or is it also the data?
Well, that depends on how you want to do it. That's really your choice. I think we will have something that will pass along data, because that's a lot easier to use. You always, of course, have to make the choice if you want to pass the entire instance, for example, attach it to the message, or if you really, for example, for an inventory updated message, you could just attach the inventory, or you could also just have the number with the resource ID and the amount and attach that. And that really kind of depends on how many messages you have, how much memory it takes, and stuff like that. So you can do that basically how you want.
Yeah, because I found out you're using Python. I coded an engine in C++.
Yeah.
And I found out that once I used a message bus, I created an hierarchy of messages.
Yeah.
For the message bus. So with the type of message, it was all complex again. So that was a bit of a problem. That may not happen in Python, of course.
Yeah, well, it will probably happen in Python also, yeah. So what did you do to fix that? Or was it a big problem, or is it just like...
I first used the inheritance strategy.
Yep.
And I tried this one, still on some branch.
Okay.
How do you implement artificial intelligence with component-based game? For example, should interact with every component of the structure?
Our artificial intelligence was implemented our last Google Summer of Code, and I'm very sorry to say I have no idea how it works because I have never worked with it. But what it basically does is creates a model of the entire kind of every building. It has an internal model that where it stores what it produces and where it can build it. It somehow works on that, and I'm not really sure how that affects the component-based representation of the buildings actually.
How do you index your components? Do they have a component type or something? And also, when do you allow some kind of subclassing for components? Like you have a weapons component, and that can actually be a sword component or something.
Yes, I have subclassing. Basically, every component has a string as an identifier, and if I subclass something, I will not overwrite the name, so that if I call the get component function, I can just give in the name and it will still return the subclassed thing. So that works pretty well.
Did you have any problems deciding which things you move data from code, or it wasn't an issue?
From data to code?
No, from code to data. I see that instance variables, most of them want to move to data.
Yeah, well, you want to move everything to data. Yeah. Every single, pretty much every number that you can somehow change and that somehow affects what happens, you want to put that outside into data. Yes?
You know Unbound, the roguelike game.
Yeah.
It has a similar approach. It has everything in data files, which are text files.
Yes.
And one thing I noticed is that because to implement something completely new, you would have to write some code. And to create a new monster that just has slightly different statistics, you just have to fill in those statistics.
Yes.
This way, Angband tends to have a lot of very similar monsters, a lot of things that are not really very different from each other.
Yeah, one thing you can do is, for example, how ZeroID did that. Let me just go back here. In ZeroID, you can actually kind of have subclassing in your object description. So here you can see this unit actually is inherited from the Card Cavalry Spearman. So it takes all the attributes that are stored for this super type, let's say, and it inherits them. Thereby, you kind of avoid duplicating everything.
But I mean, in the game.
Yeah.
Then the game becomes less interesting because everything in the game is the same. You know, your content creators.
Yeah.
Have this are encouraged to make a lot of similar things because.
Yeah, but does that
things that are different? They need to put in more work.
Yeah, that is obviously true, but that is a problem of your content creators, not not the design.
Is there a game design that will encourage people to create lots of different content?
The general experience is that people will create different things you never even thought about.
Yeah.
You don't have to provide a really, really easy mechanism to make it differently. The people will make it differently. We have our experience with this. We have some really strange things on our add-on server going on. Things we never thought about possible. It's freaking fantastic to see what they're able to do.
You can look at Minecraft.
Yes.
There's
no reason to really make it especially
for
easy
Unreal
to do it differ from
yeah.
the normal stuff.
No, we have
there will be ways
the
found,
GUI, but
they will be used.
Yeah, but you're still trying
game
to do something.
No, we are not trying to do that currently. Because that is
as I said,
kind of my decision because I want to have everything in one place. And for me, that's okay if we
yes.
duplicate some
yes.
lines in the text file. I don't care.
Do you have components for the weapon. So you try to define a weapon, different types of swords. So in your way, how did you do it? You define it as a type of, I don't know, blading them, speed, damage, things like that?
No, just a second. Okay, I think so we can close now because the next talk is coming up. And if you have more questions, just come up and bombard me.